sure that this works. Ah, there we go. Now you can hear me, right? Great. Thank you. Well, thank you, Ian. It's a pleasure to be here again. And today I want to do something a little bizarre. I'm a neuroeconomist by avocation and vocation. That means that I simultaneously study human decision making from the point of view of economics, which is sort of the highest level theoretical, pure mathematical view of human decision making, from the level of psychology, where we think about things like the hopes and desires which move us, and from the level of neurobiology, where we think about the neural circuits that actually make decisions. Of course, the question that arises immediately when I get asked to do the James Arthur lecture is, how does the human brain and how does the human decision-making structure relate to evolutionary biology? Now, that's actually an extremely old debate and one that has its origins around the time Darwin began to think about this problem. You see, economists for now, 350, 400 years, have been asking, how is it that human beings, when they make decisions, identify the things they want most and maximize their acquisition of those things being love, happiness, spouses, you shouldn't be maximizing spouses, but you get the idea. So this notion that we maximize our welfare by our decisions is a really core idea. And the idea is that if economics works, if we structure markets and environments correctly, our behavior allows us to efficiently maximize our own welfare. That's an idea that's really quite close to Darwin's notion that when animals are under the pressure of natural selection, what they do is seek, in an evolutionary timescale, to maximize their fitness. The critical idea here is that Darwin was really inspired. This, I should tell you, is Adam Smith. This is obviously Darwin. Darwin was inspired in his day by the thoughts of economists. Economists had been thinking that what people were trying to do with their behavior was to maximize their welfare, that they did this by working in their own self-interest, that the sort of force that does the maximizing is self-interest, and that the action that they use in order to achieve that maximization are choices. In the famous metaphor some of you may know of Darwin struggling to get through Piccadilly Circus while reading Malthus, he had this intuition that the struggle for existence and for welfare was a model for thinking about the struggle for survival. Now, of course, Darwin turned in a different direction and argued that it's evolution or natural selection which drive a maximization of gene frequencies that we measure essentially in Darwin's days through traits. So I want to make it clear that these are related ideas, but they're not exactly the same idea. And there's been a lot of back and forth between economics and evolutionary biology over the course of the last, let's say, 100 years about how related these ideas are and whether one should or should not be impacting the other. Now, the person who's really seen as the great sort of searchlight for this interaction is the very, very famous English biologist John Maynard Keynes. That's a famous economist. Very, very famous English biologist John Maynard Smith. And Maynard Smith, who died recently, was really famous for taking a lot of the mathematics of economics and importing it into the competitions and decisions that animals have with each other at an evolutionary level to think about maximization of fitness and survival. But he was really down on economics, extremely down on it. I want to read you a famous passage from one of his books. Paradoxically, it's turned out that game theory, that's a branch of the economics of decision making, is more readily applied to biology than to the field of economic behavior for which it was originally designed. There are two reasons. At this point, most of my economist friends cringe. There are two reasons for this. First, the theory requires that the values of different outcomes might be measured on a single scale. In human applications, this measure is provided by utility. Maynard Smith says, a somewhat artificial and uncomfortable concept. In biology, Darwinian fitness provides a natural and genuinely one-dimensional scale. Secondly, and more importantly, in seeking the solution of a game, the concept, I can skip all of this. So the critical idea here that Maynard Smith wants us to take away is, genes are real, people organisms maximize them through interaction. That's what evolution's about. But your welfare is not real. And so it's kind of hard to know when you're better off and when you're worse off. You might not feel that way. And so we have to see these two theories as one being sort of about a real thing and one being a sort of about a multidimensional made-up thing. Now, what I want to argue to you today is that that's wrong. That in actual fact, these two theories are almost exactly the same thing, and that when we look at this process within the behavior of a single individual, we're actually looking at this process, that these two things are really the same thing, that they're two sides of the same coin. Now, to do that, what I want to do is I first want to talk to you a little bit about evolution. I want to tell you a bunch of cute stories, many of which you may know, and then I want to try and bleed those across into the theory of decision making and choice. So let's turn first to evolution. Now, what we're thinking when we think about evolution is that species are under the pressure of natural selection. More fit animals survive, less fit animals are selected against, and the result is that animals evolve towards more fit forms. Put the way it usually is, natural selection pushes animals towards what we usually call higher fitness. In this little cartoon, you're supposed to imagine that this is a landscape of possible traits, let's say skin color. And the height of each of these peaks tells you how fit, how well you survive with any one of those traits, let's say anywhere in the spectrum of skin color. So what we learn is that evolution pushes us towards an uphill drive, but what we worry about is that evolution might not really reliably be able to find the absolute peak, but might get us stuck at these local peaks. This is a really important point, because if evolution doesn't achieve a maximization of fitness, and I'm going to tell you that economics argues that at least to some degree humans do, then these two processes can't really be related. One really works and one really doesn't. So the critical idea then has to become that both evolution and people's decision making come near to approximating this ideal. Now that's an extremely controversial thing to say. And most evolutionary biologists 30 years ago were really on the fence about this. This is something that comes and goes kind of with the tide in evolutionary biology circles. For a while, everyone's for this idea that animals achieve near, I don't want to say perfect, that's too strong, achieve highly efficient forms. And then for 20 or 30 years, evolutionary biologists will be against that idea and then it'll come back. And basically, it's a matter of graduate students killing their mentors. But the evidence for this is usually in two forms. Let me start with the one that you usually see, and that's what we call convergent evolution. Imagine we had two organisms that start in wildly different places. They had different skin color, different numbers of legs, something like that. And we allowed evolution to operate on them in the same environment. If there really is a best way to be that animal, of course, we'd expect that if we came back in n million years, all those animals would look exactly the same. They'd either have died out or they'd evolve to the basic form, which is best for that environment. Now, we don't really know whether that works, and these are hard to think about, let alone do experiments on, but there are a lot of neat stories that lie here. Here I'm showing you one of the pretty famous ones. These are both saber-toothed tigers. The one on the left is actually a marsupial saber-toothed tiger, and the one on the right is a real saber-toothed tiger. These are two animals that looked almost identical. You can see that they have essentially the same skull shape, the same highly evolved, super long teeth. But these animals came from very different backgrounds. This animal evolved basically from a kangaroo, or actually he evolved from an echidna, which is a kind of nasty little porcupine thing. And of course, this little guy evolved from something more like a tree shrew. So it's interesting, you have some nasty little porcupine and some nasty little tree shrew, you put them in the same environment and they wind up looking about the same. It could be a coincidence, it could be a local minima that both are driven to. But it's an interesting observation, and it's not unique. I could show you tons of these. This is one I really like. This is the skeleton of an ichthyosaur. That's a dinosaur. It's a reptile from the period of the dinosaurs. It was a terrestrial reptile, and it evolved into an aquatic form. Here you can see a picture of this little guy. He breathed air. If he was a girl, he gave birth to live young, tail first. And of course, this is a dolphin. This is an animal that descends basically from cows. And so here you have a reptile and a cow, and I mean, it's striking how similar these two creatures look to each other. And one can't help but wonder if that's because the environment they're in is one that shaped them so strongly that they're now well suited to their environment. But the most striking example of this, and the one I always like to talk about, is the evolutionary progress of the cichlid fishes of the African Rift Valley. So here what I'm showing you is, of course, a satellite shot from Google of Africa with a zoom in here in the region of the African Rift Valley, here's Lake Victoria, here's Lake Tanganyika, and here's Lake Malawi. And living in these lakes are tons and tons of fishes from the family cichlid. Now, you probably have seen cichlid fishes at your local fish store. This is a highly diverse clade or group of fishes. They have lots of interesting different characteristics. They're actually specialized for fairly rapid evolution. But what's interesting is that each lake was essentially founded by one group, small group, sometimes as little as a single species of cichlids, which found its way into that lake some long time ago. The cichlids that first colonized Lake Malawi got there about 10 million years ago. The cichlid family that first colonized Tanganyika got there about 1 million years ago. And the cichlid group, as best we can date it, that first colonized Lake Victoria did so about 100,000 years ago. And the cichlids that went into each of those lakes looked really different. They had very, very different appearances, different colors, different structures, different shapes. But each has lived in an almost identical environment. And so a natural question to ask is, if anything I'm telling you is true, the cichlids you find in one lake ought to look a lot like the cichlids in the other lake, even though they started out looking different. So here's a very famous analysis, stolen really from a famous analysis by Axel Meyer, showing you on the left a group of five species from Lake Tanganyika, and on the right a group of five species from Lake Malawi. Now what's really startling about this is this fish and this fish and this fish and this fish and this fish are really closely related to each other. And they're completely unrelated to these fish. And this fish and this fish and this fish and this fish and this fish, they're really closely related to each other. In Lake Victoria, that's only had 100,000 years to do this, we actually still can see these same five fishes, but they kind of look a little bit more alike. This little guy is a little bit fatter and not quite as yellowy. And this little guy hasn't yet evolved such a big bump on his head, although he has one. And he's a little more browny colored. So, I mean, that's striking, I think. And while it really can't prove anything, I think it really does raise this interesting question of whether or not the animals we find lying around in the planet are pretty well adapted to their environments, whether evolution has pushed them to a pretty high degree of fitness. And if it has pushed them to a high degree of fitness, what does that tell us about the efficiency of the underlying process? Now, the problem with the story I've just told you is that, you know, it's kind of a just-so story. I show you these great pictures of neat fishes that I have cherry-picked from the millions of possible fishes and show you that they do actually look alike. And I show you that ichthyosaurs look like dolphins. Now, I don't show you that the plesiosaurs, which replace them, don't look anything like anything that's in the ocean today. And so you have every reason to say, you know, that's a neat story. I'm going to go home and tell my kids that. But I'm kind of unconvinced that you have proven to me that anything going on here is truly efficient. And the reason is I haven't given you any measures of efficiency. What I really need to do to make this case is I need to find something that animals do whose accuracy or efficiency I can quantify quite precisely. And then I need to see how good a job animals do. And of course, the trick here, and this is where I'm going to turn now towards neuroeconomics, is we're going to turn away from things like body form and towards things like behavioral decision making. Because here's a place we can make really we can assess the efficiency of decision making. Let me tell you my absolute favorite story of this. This is Gary Belovsky's moose. This is actually, Gary Belovsky's a biologist, a mathematical evolutionary biologist, and a foraging theorist. This is actually not his moose, this is a moose. But Belovsky is really interested in the question of how moose decide what to eat. Now, if you're a moose and you're living on in the American, let's say the northern central plains of the United States or Canada, you have basically two food choices during the summer. You can eat grass, like he's standing in, or you can eat sort of nasty algae glop that lives in just under the water in these ponds. So your only choice is, should I eat grass or should I eat nasty algae glop? Now, you face a couple of problems that we can define for the moose. The first problem you face is that salt can only be had in the nasty algae glop. So if you don't eat any of that, you'll die from lack of salt. The second problem you face is that the ponds freeze over in winter. So that means you have to get all your salt for the year in the summer. The next problem you face is you need a certain number of calories. You need to put on calories. If you get too few calories, you die. So you have to trade this off. And what makes it challenging is that salt only comes from the water plants, but the bulk of your calories have to come from the land plants because they're more nutritious. Okay, so let's think about mathematically the problem that the moose is trying to solve. So here what I'm plotting for you is how much of the dry, how much green glop of algae you're going to eat each day, and how much nice, tasty grass you're going to eat each day. Remember, salt only comes from this side. So I'll just draw this line here at about 850 grams of this dry, this wet, gloppy stuff. If you eat less than this, you don't get enough salt. If you eat more than this, you get enough salt. So you've got to stay above this line all summer long or you die in the winter from lack of salt. Okay, but you have other constraints. This line plots the trade-off between wet and dry material in terms of calories. Every point on this line, here's one where you eat a lot of wet plants. Here's one where you eat a lot of dry plants. Every point on this line tells you a combination that's good enough to support you in terms of your caloric need. If you stay above this line, you're getting enough calories. If you go below this line, you're not getting enough calories. Okay, now you face one other problem, and that is, although you are a big giant moose, you have a not-so-huge stomach. I mean, you actually have a huge stomach, but a moose would like a larger stomach. And so there's a maximum amount of food you can put inside your stomach. This yellow line is how much stuff you can jam into your mouth each day. And so you can't go into this domain because you'll just barf. Okay, so here's this neat constraint. The moose has to live under this yellow line, above this red line, and to the right of this blue line if he's going to live. Now, we can actually go a step further, and we can measure how many calories he's actually got at each point in this white square. And it turns out that this point, this corner on the far right, is exactly the place that gives you the most calories and meets all those constraints. So Belovsky's graduate students went out, they watched moose for hours and hours and hours and hours, and you know where the moose wind up on this graph? Of course, it's right here. Now, I'm not suggesting that the moose, in their decision-making, are sitting there like with this graph, like, take a bite, think about it. But I am telling you that the moose, somehow or other, in his decision about these two classes of plants, solves this problem perfectly. Now, it's tempting to say that he maximizes his evolutionary fitness by doing so. But remember that I use the word evolutionary fitness and not welfare, even though we're really talking about a choice problem, and that seems reasonable because after all, I'm talking about a moose, not a person or anything like that. But the reason I bring that up is I want to show you here that these two ideas, the traits that we measure and the choices that Adam Smith measured, those are sometimes the same thing. And I think that provides the critical linkage. If I can convince you that what's going on down here is really, really, really efficient, then I think by default I've convinced you that if you believe this is a maximization process that's maximizing gene frequencies plausibly well, it must also be the case that this is the same thing. So let me develop that in a couple of other ways. First, what I want to do is I want to tell you about food choice. This is one of the other really famous foraging problems. And so this little guy, Paris Major, he's called the Great Tit in England, where that's not funny for some reason. And what this little guy needs to do is he needs to decide what to eat. So he might have to be thinking to himself, gosh, I'd like to eat some of these delicious mealworms. I'd like to eat some of this delicious birdseed. This bunch of bugs looks really good to me. But the critical question I want to ask is, how good is he at making his food choices? Now, it turns out that the math for understanding food choices is pretty complicated, and it was developed by this guy, Rick Charnov. And what Rick did essentially was he said, gosh, the first decision that this little bird has to do if he's trying to maximize the number of calories he gets per hour is every time he sees something he can eat, he has to say, is it worth taking the time to eat that thing? Or would I better spend my time hunting for something better? That's a hard choice, right? But it should be obvious that if there's a lot of stuff in my environment, I can be real picky if I'm constantly encountering food at short intervals. On the other hand, if there's a very little stuff, I can't afford to be very picky. So that's going to be kind of obvious. We should see more picky birds in under conditions in which there's more food generally available. But what Rick proved mathematically, which was really interesting, was something that nowadays is called the 0-1 rule. What he proved was that when you encounter a particular food type, let's say a mealworm, a particular environment might call for you to eat that mealworm. And if it does, you must eat it every time you see it. It might call for you to ignore a beetle because it's not good enough in this environment. And if it calls for that, you must never eat a beetle no matter how often you see it. Rick's proof demonstrated that the way you maximize food is actually by rank ordering your different prey items, going down that list based on the frequencies with which they occur in your environment, figuring out how many of each you need to live in a day, drawing a straight line, and never touching anything below the line. If I make food rarer, you might have to go lower. If I make it more plentiful, you go up. But you always obey this rule of rank ordering the foods, eating all the stuff above your line, and never eating the stuff below your line, hence 0 and 1. Now, John Krebs, about 20 years ago, decided to test that. And he tested it in this little guy I was showing you, Parus Major. And so this is the kind of experiment any evolutionary biologist should love, just because it's kind of kooky and you make it with styrofoam and things like that. Okay, so here's this little birdie. He's sitting on a little perch on this little floor with a hole cut in it. Underneath the floor is a conveyor belt, which is actually much longer than this, with a row of graduate students. This is like going to be like the I Love Lucy scene with the chocolates. Now, the graduate students are holding mealworms, and this is kind of nasty. Now, you know mealworms are made out of segments, and so what they've done is they've classified the mealworms into basically short, medium, and long mealworms with a knife. So they just, it's kind of nasty, right? They're going to cut 3-segment mealworms, they'll cut like 7-segment mealworms, they'll cut 10-segment mealworms, and so the graduate students are going to be dropping onto the platform, onto the conveyor belt, mealworms of different sizes. And they're going to change the speed the conveyor belt's moving. They're going to change the relative frequencies of the different mealworms. So the kid holding the small mealworms is like, your turn, go fast. And what they're going to do is see what this little guy does. But before they do that, they'll actually compute all the optimal solutions. And sure enough, this little guy hits every single optimal solution dead on. If they adjust the speed of the platform so it's moving faster, he starts to ignore the 3-segment mealworms. And he always drops them. At exactly some critical speed, the 3-segment mealworms drop out of his diet. As they pick up the speed the next notch, the 7-segment mealworms drop out of his diet, and they do so all at once. If they start throwing extra 3-segment mealworms, he ignores them. Extra 7s, he ignores them. If they slow it down, he picks back up the 7s. If they cover the little conveyor belt with 3-segment worms, he won't touch them as long as his food rule says don't touch them. And so this is another example where we see a set of decisions which appear to maximize something. If we're thinking about birds, we're probably thinking they're maximizing evolutionary fitness, or at least pushing in that direction. If these were people, you might feel differently. Okay, so let me tell you a little bit related story about people. Now, this is one of my graduate students, Sarah Constantino. She's looking extremely frustrated because she's actually, this is a picture from the Daily Telegraph. She's actually trapped at Heathrow. She's been at Heathrow for about 2.5 days now, waiting for her British Airways plane to take off. So she's trying to decide, should I abandon British Airways, which we can think of as a foraging patch? She's foraging for a way back to graduate school, which is might be madness in and of itself, and go to one of these other patches, or should I stay? Now, the interesting thing is that Rick also wrote out a theorem for this, although he was thinking about animals. So let me show you, when Sarah got back, she invented this experiment. So let me show you this experiment. Here's an apple tree. You're a subject, you're a human being, and you're a subject in Sarah's experiment. And you are going to make a decision about whether to shake that tree in order to get some apples out of it, or whether to look for a new tree that might have more apples in it. So the decision you're making now is not, should I eat it or not, but should I keep foraging here or leave? And so what you're going to do is you're going to shake the tree, and a bunch of apples fall down. And this is really what it looks like when a human does this experiment. and you'll shake it the second time, and fewer apples will fall down. Well, that makes sense. You're getting the apples out of this tree. You shake it again. Well, this is now a lousy tree to be sitting in. This is the point at which you leave British Airways in Sarah's story and switch to United or whatever. So you might choose to do that in such an experiment and then find yourself at a new tree. Okay, so the critical idea Sarah's going to ask is, look, I'm going to adjust how many pieces of fruit fall off each tree, how that declines, how quickly the trees deplete. I'm going to adjust the travel time, how long it takes to get from tree to tree. And then I'm going to write down mathematically what the optimal solution is for any given travel time, for any given tree density, for any given apple falling rate, all these different things. There's an optimal time to stay foraging at each tree before you give up and go to the next tree. And this has been heavily studied in animals, and animals nail it. They get it right every time. But that's about maximizing gene frequency, not about maximizing welfare, human welfare. So what Sarah did is she brought a pile of New York University undergraduates into the lab, and she just had them play this game. And she said, hey, try and collect as many apples as you can. And I won't belabor the details. Here are four different environments they were foraging in, plotted in different colors. And these dashed lines show the optimal number of apples you should get before you leave. That is to say, once you get less than six apples, it's actually 5.5 apples, just under that number, you should abandon this and go to a new apple tree in this particular environment, which is not very apple rich. In this environment, which is a much more apple rich environment, you should really stay there until you're closer to seven apples. Now, what I want you to see is that this NYU undergraduate takes a few trials to figure this out, and then he nails the optimal choice strategy. And then she changes it on him, and he hovers for a moment, but he basically nails the optimal choice strategy, and he nails it again, and he nails it again, and this is typical of everyone she's ever studied. Okay, so what am I telling you first here? Remember, we're trying to ask whether the relationship between the choices people make, their efficiencies, the evolutionary processes that drive efficient decision-making, and animal behavior. Well, that's a story that seems to be pretty comfortable. And here what I've tried to do is switch it to human behavior, because what I really want to argue is that the human behavior is interesting because we're humans, and because there's where we're thinking about economics. Now, you might at this moment say, yeah, okay, look, Glimcher, that's great. I mean, people foraging for apples, this is clearly not neuroeconomics. This is not stock picks. This is not money. Now, let me reveal one last fact to you, which is that these subjects are actually trading their apples for money, and they know it. What they're actually doing in this experiment is gathering as many apples as they can, and at the end of the game, they hand those apples in at 10 cents on the apple, and that's how much money they go home with. So these people are doing a classic animal foraging problem, but they're doing it for money. And they nail it, just as precisely as the animals did. Their efficiencies are well above 95%. Okay? So that's kind of interesting. Now, the next question I think that comes up then is, okay, you've told me this story that animals, when we can measure their efficiency as decision makers, evolution seems to have pushed them to be almost perfect decision makers in the environments where they're making decisions. Humans, when they make similar decisions, seem to have similar properties, whether those are about apples or about something as abstract as money. I kind of believe the same is true if we were talking about love or I'm gonna go stray into a bad domain there, so let's just leave that. Okay. So then the critical question I think becomes, well, can I provide evidence to you that the mechanisms the animals are using to maximize their fitness neurobiologically, the brain mechanisms that achieve this, are the same brain mechanisms that maximize apple choices and economic decision making in Sarah's human subjects? So let me show you the first hint that that's true. And this is a really terrible, blatant example. What we're going to do now is we're going to look at a different decision-making problem. It's also going to be one of these toy foraging problems. We're going to look at real humans doing it. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to study two groups of people doing it. One of them are going to be normal, healthy college undergraduates at NYU. And the second group are going to be Parkinson's patients off their medication. Now, as many of you know, Parkinson's is a disease usually of the sixth or seventh decade of life. So people are usually around 70 years old when they get Parkinson's disease. And it arises because of damage to a subsystem of the brain called the dopamine neurons. And as I'll show you in a moment, we now think that the processes I just showed you, whether they're going on in the head of a small bird, a moose, or a human, are actually mediated by this system of dopamine neurons, which is damaged in Parkinson's disease. Okay, so let me show you Rob's. This is the story of one of my former graduate students, Rob Rutledge, who's now at University College London. And so what Rob did was design what we call the crab fishing game. In the crab fishing game, there are a group of crabs hidden under each of these buoys. You don't know how many. Crabs blunder into traps. Once they get in a trap, they get caught. When you pull up a trap, if there's a crab in it, we give you 9 cents. If you pull up a trap and there's no crab in it, we give you nothing. And so what you have to decide on each round is how to split your time between these two traps. This is actually a pretty fun game, I have to say. I put too many slides in because it's fun to do. And interestingly, elders really, our elder Parkinson's patients really enjoy playing it. Okay, so here what I'm plotting for you is what a healthy undergraduate does under these conditions. What you're looking at is each of their decisions basically ranked in time from the first to the last. These are 800 choices. The vertical lines separate conditions. So in this first condition, there are three green crabs. Here, for every three red crabs, there's one green crab. And these blue lines show you the optimal strategy, the relative time you should be spending on the red versus the green buoy. And you can see that NYU undergraduates pretty much figure this out. They sometimes don't notice the switches, particularly in the beginning, but they do a remarkably good job of almost perfectly following the distribution of crabs under the two buoys. But here's the neat thing. Elders do a great job at this too, but elders with Parkinson's disease, when they're off their medicine, do not. This is an elder patient off their Parkinson's medication. And what I want you to see is they don't have this nice crisp thing where they find the best. They sort of hover noisily, randomly through the middle. And so this was our really first big hint that the processes that we're operating here involved something that we could reach into the brain and study. In this case, it's the neurotransmitter dopamine. And that these processes might be the same in humans and in animals. So the critical next step then becomes a really systematic effort to understand whether money and natural rewards are the same thing to the brain, whether the systems that maximize how much money you get and the systems that maximize how many apples you get are the same, or mealworms you get are the same. And if they are and they're efficient, then we've really made the case that when we look at human economic behavior, we're looking at an evolved fit behavior. Now to do that, my lab and about two others in the world have turned really intensely to the study of these dopamine neurons. This is a side view of a human brain. Your eye would be right here. And there's this little nut-shaped object down in the base of the brain. There are actually three of them, which are called the dopamine nuclei. And in these three nuclei live the cells that use dopamine as their chemical transmitter, the tool by which they talk to other parts of the brain. Now, they actually send connecting wires called axons out to other parts of the brain, the frontal cortex and the basal ganglia. And these two parts of the brain receive a sort of wash of dopamine from the activity of these nerve cells under some conditions that are critical for making good decisions. Now, the person who first really figured that out was this guy, Wolfram Schultz. Wolfram is now in London, but was at Freiburg when he did this. And what he did was he recorded from the activity of individual dopamine nerve cells in a group of rhesus monkeys while they made a decision. While they engaged in a simple foraging task. He studied three conditions, which I'm going to show you, and then I'll explain to you how we put this story together. In the first condition, the monkey is just given a raisin without any warning. So the monkey's just sitting there, he's in his little chair, sort of bored, looking around, all of a sudden, clonk, a raisin falls in front of him, he grabs it and eats it. And what I'm showing you is the activity here of a dopamine neuron, so higher means the neuron's more active, lower means he's less active. These are individual trials, which we're not going to worry about. And R, this bar, marks the time at which Wolfram drops the raisin in. This is supposed to be very much like that little bird experiment. Every time Wolfram drops the raisin in, the dopamine neurons respond with a burst of activity and send a wash of dopamine throughout all of their target region. Now, this is a little more interesting. In a second part of the experiment, a light comes on, and a second later, the raisin drops. The very first time you do this, you get a burst of activity at the time of the raisin, shown here. There's no burst here because this is actually after training. After training, once the animals learn that the light always predicts the raisin, the activity of the neuron changes, and it shows so that it shows a burst of activity at the unexpected light, but not at the time of the now completely expected raisin. And what a group of us hypothesized after Wolfram published these data was that what these neurons were actually doing was learning something. See, in this condition, they're struggling to learn why they got the raisin. And in this condition, they no longer need to learn anything about the raisin because they know it's coming. But they're struggling here to learn something about what that light means and why it comes on suddenly. In fact, if we put a second light that predicts the first light, we find that in time, these neurons stop firing in response to the first light, this light, but fire to the earlier light. Why? Because they've now learned everything there is to learn about the first light, and they're now struggling to learn something new about the second light. In fact, what we've come to argue is that what these dopamine neurons actually do is keep precise count, not of how much reward you got, but of how much more reward you got than you expected. And we've made the argument that these target regions then use this information to quite precisely track the reward they get at each instant, whether it's above or below some basic criterion, some decision threshold. And the work of my lab over the course of the last decade has really been an effort to demonstrate that all the variables that would be needed to track the decisions of these little birds, or to track the decisions of humans making decisions about apples, or to track the decisions of humans making financial decisions, are mediated by a complex structure here, a set of neurons that are designed for efficient learning of the values of our actions. Now, this is really a very intense argument about precise efficiency, which takes a good deal of time to get through precisely. I'm not really going to try and do that with you today. I'm just going to tell you a couple little experiments and sort of try and show you how they fit together into a larger picture. This is Hannah Baer, another one of my graduate students, who is now an editor of a major neuroscience journal. And what Hannah did was study the activity of dopamine neurons while she trained monkeys to perform this really crazy foraging task. So in this task, the monkeys are actually foraging with their eyes. This is a simplification because all you have to do is work with monkeys grabbing on levers for a while to realize how incredibly unpleasant the levers get fast. And so we often use video systems to track where they're looking, and we let them press the levers with their eye, which I have to say is so much neater than when you let them touch things with their hands. I should also add that they're going to make foraging decisions with their eyes, and then they're going to get as their reward beriberi fruit juice, not raisins. Monkeys love beriberi fruit juice for reasons that are probably lost in evolutionary time. And so we'll stick with that. It's much easier to deliver than throwing raisins at monkeys. Okay, so here's the deal. The monkey's going to stare straight ahead. She waits for this light to come on. As soon as she sees it, she looks at it. Then that's her telling us, I'm ready for my next decision. And then after a little delay, Hannah lights up this target. And that second target says to the monkey, now this is a time foraging task. You look at that target whenever you want to, monkey. It's up to you. Now what Hannah does that's tricky is she sets up this rule, which we call the reinforcement contingency. And this little ramp indicates the structure of this rule. If the monkey looks, so here we're moving through time, if the monkey looks right here, she gets a little tiny reward. If she looks here, she gets a kind of medium-sized reward. If she looks here, she gets a really big reward. And if she waits too long, she gets no reward. So what's the monkey's job? The monkey's job is to find this ramp and sort of climb up towards the top. Of course, what we're going to do that's terrible is as soon as she starts getting close to the top, we will move the ramp. And suddenly, she'll be like, oh no, I have to find the ramp again. This is what a typical monkey does when she's faced with that task. So here, what I'm plotting for you is how long the monkey decided to wait against which trial the monkey's in, and these little orange squares indicate those ramps sort of viewed from the top. So here's the bottom of the ramp where you get a crummy reward, here's waiting a little longer, here's waiting a little longer, here's waiting a really long time for the best reward, here's waiting too long, you got nothing. And you can see that Hannah's monkey does this nice climb up the ramp, and then we move it just as she gets close, and you can see she's completely frustrated. It takes her a long time to even find the ramp. The ramp's actually real close now. This is a really rapid movement. And then we move the ramp way out, and she starts to climb up towards it, and then we move it on her again. This time, she really quickly climbs up to the optima, so you get the idea. Now, the reason this task was structured this way, and this is really going to be math voodoo, I'm not going to bother trying to explain it unless someone wants to ask at the end, is we structure it because on every trial, we know how many spikes, how many action potentials the dopamine neurons produced, and we know the history of rewards that they're trying to keep track of. These are the last 10 different juice rewards. This monkey might have gotten 0.26 milliliters of beriberi juice here, the trial before 0.24, the trial before 0.28, the trial 9 before 0, she missed the ramp completely, and the trial 10 ago, 0.22 milliliters of juice. So this is what the monkey's going to be learning about. These are her decision criteria. And what we can do is we can extract mathematically what the pattern of activity these neurons would have to show would be if they were perfectly tracking the decisional criteria, if they were perfectly learning the value of juice from their recent history. Now, this is a purely theoretical curve. I'm not going to really focus on the details of what these curves are. They're actually a weighting function that tell us essentially how much each reward in the past counts for this neuron. An ideal weighter of this data pays a lot of negative attention to the reward one trial ago, almost no attention to what happened 10 trials ago, and a lot of positive attention to the reward you just got. And it's a critical side point that we ought to be able to use this function to construct a more abstract measure that relates the ideal learning rule to the firing rate of the neuron. Now, what we can do is actually ask, well, what do neurons actually do? And there are sort of no constraints on what function I can get out. And this is what neurons actually do. This is about as, in biology, about as perfect a match between theory and data as you ever see. These curves are exactly those predicted by the theoretical analysis. And so the story I'm telling you is what? The story I'm telling you is essentially the same foraging story. We can write out an optimal foraging rule now, not at the level of mealworms, but at the level of the individual action potentials of nerve cells in the brain. And then we can ask, do these systems that we think mediate foraging in animals, which looks like it's dead-on perfect, do the same kind of dead-on perfect calculations? And the answer is yes, they do. I'd like to have these two slides together because, you know, in your career you get one or two things this good. And you just have to go back and forth and feel good about that. Okay, great. Is that true in humans? Now, I'm not going to tell you those stories because they're equally long and I've got sort of 8-ish more minutes to talk to you. But we have done these same kinds of experiments in humans. Now, in humans it's a little more complicated because we have to use brain scanners, which are big, nasty, expensive microwave ovens. That you shove people into. But what we can do in the brain scanner is we can measure the activity, not of these actual nerve cells, but we can sort of measure indirectly how much dopamine they've spritzed out. Because this dopamine causes a change in brain activity, where it spritzes out. And by measuring activity, let's say in this chunk of brain, where dopamine's being released at a time we think it's being released, we can perform the same kinds of analyses. We can write out these optimal equations, and we can ask, what's the activity look like in these dopamine target regions? Here I'm just showing you a cross-section of a human brain. This is a cut sort of this way, what we call a coronal cut, and this is a horizontal cut. And in red, I'm showing you the areas whose activity precisely matches the theoretical prediction for an optimal foraging system. And what's interesting is this is exactly the major target of dopamine in the brain. I'm searching for optimal foraging class equations, and I'm finding the same dopamine neurons that in the monkeys we thought were doing a basically optimal job of the foraging calculation. Okay. So, what have I told you? Darwin started out taking a look at the behavior of the economists. What economists like Malthus and Adam Smith were arguing was that when you gave people a set of choices, by their actions, they struggled to maximize their welfare. They performed implicitly some set of calculations which yielded a maximum benefit to them. Over the course of the next 150, 200 years, we've really come to the view that evolution does exactly that, but it does it with regard to gene frequencies. That what evolution does is it pushes animals towards, maybe not all the way to, but that it pushes animals towards having efficient systems that maximize not welfare, not wealth, not happiness, but gene frequencies. But the critical idea that got dropped here was the notion that many, many, many of the traits that we study, which are of course generated by gene frequencies, are actually traits that generate choices. Inasmuch as we believe that gene frequencies express efficient traits, and we believe these traits are actually embodied in choices, we're really making the argument that choices maximize gene frequencies. Now, if Adam Smith is right, then that really implies that to some degree, gene frequencies and personal welfare are really closely related. These must be almost identical things in some spaces, some places. Okay, so the argument I've made to you basically so far is that humans and animals nail efficient foraging. And the reason they do it is because they use the same mechanism, and that's an evolved mechanism, and it maximizes both personal welfare and long-run genetic frequencies, because those are kind of almost the same thing. Okay, so at this point, you know, some of you may be convinced of that. The curators sitting there in the corner are just probably at this point ready to kill themselves. And they're probably asking exactly what Maynard Smith would have asked, which is, for heaven's sakes, you've cherry-picked these silly examples. Everybody knows that people are terrible decision makers. All you have to do is pick up one of the 9,000 self-help books in the, you know, Barnes & Noble. I mean, there have been more books written in the last 5 years that go something like, all neurobiologists know people are stupid. And here's how you can avoid that. And so surely that must be true. Surely we can find examples where that's true. And we can disprove this whole line of argument. Okay, let me try and do that. And the one I want to turn to is really my favorite member of this class of examples. This is what's often called the curse of choice. Now, many of you may associate this with the books of Barry Schwartz. The person who really did these experiments is a Columbia University psychologist by the name of Sheena Iyengar. And Sheena studied places in human decision-making where people get really inefficient. And her most famous example is the curse of the jelly jars. Okay, so here's the curse of the jelly jars. Sheena goes to Fairway, and she sets up a table with a little red check, you know, tablecloth. And she goes and she gets these six jellies, and she puts them on her little table. She opens them up. She puts crackers on the table, six knives in all the jelly jars, and has a stack of coupons. Little do they know she's a Columbia psychologist. When people, and a pretty formidable mathematician at that. So people walk by Sheena's little counter, and she says, excuse me, would you like to try my jellies? Okay, well, if you try all six of my jellies, I will give you one of these coupons. And these coupons will give you $1 off should you choose to purchase any of our brand. Where by our brand, she actually means I don't know what, because she doesn't work for the company. And, okay, and you can only get the jellies, the $1 off coupon, if you write your email address on this, because she wants to write you and ask you how happy you are with your jellies. Okay, when she does this with six jellies, 30% of the people who taste her six jellies turn in a coupon, buy one of the jellies, she calls them up, or she emails them a week later and says, how do you feel about your jelly? And they say, I love my jelly, 80% of the time. The next day, Sheena comes back, and in addition to these six jellies, she sets up another group of jellies, another 18 jellies, so now there are 24 jellies. And she says, taste any six of my jellies. And if you taste any six of my jellies, you can have this coupon and you can go get some jellies. Now, let me be clear about how an economist thinks about this problem. Let's imagine that for you, this correctly represents the rank order of these six jellies. This is your least favorite of these six jellies, which is mulberry or something. And here's ginger, which is your favorite of these jellies for some reason. If I add these six jellies, well, they may all be worse than ginger, but you can still pick ginger. One of them might be better than ginger for you, in which case you're better off because now you have something even better than ginger. Of course, if I put six more, the same is true. And if I put six more, the same is true. So what happens if I give you 18 more jellies? You have to be better off. Because you can't be worse off. Ginger's still there. You can only do better. But when Sheena does this experiment, what she finds is people take a look. I mean, this is intuitively obvious at some level. They take a look at these 24 jellies. They taste six of them. And they basically throw the coupon away. Only 3% of people who taste six jellies when all 24 are there actually cash in their jelly coupon. And when she calls them up and says, how do you feel about your jellies? 80% say, I am filled with regret about the jelly I purchased. Which I totally love. Okay, so what's going on? To an economist, this is really, as my grandmother would have said, a terrible Shonda. How could this be? You give people more choice, which has to make them better off, and for all the world, they look like they're less well off. How does that happen? Well, this is the kind of thing that has now gotten us stuck as economists because it looks like a place where we're diverging from the animal literature. Giving people too many options seems to screw them up and in a way that seems really, really inefficient. And I think the two people who have begun to figure that out are two postdoctoral fellows in my lab. This guy, Kenway Louie, who's actually lurking out there somewhere, and I'll show you in a moment his colleague and office mate, Ryan Webb. So what Kenway has done is he's constructed a series of experiments in which monkeys make choices amongst different kinds of jellies, basically. These are little targets that they look at that give them different kinds of juice or different amounts of juice. And he's replicated Sheena's jelly jar experiment in the monkeys, in essence. It's a little bit stripped down and, you know, it doesn't have the nice labels or anything like that. And he's been able to show that monkeys basically show all these same behaviors, but he's done it while recording from single nerve cells in the brains of these monkeys that seem to be engaged in the decision about what to choose. Now, he's generated an enormous amount of data, and for me to show that to you would take forever. But what I can do is I can show you Ryan Webb's computer simulations of this data set. It's basically just a reproduction of the data set, and I have to show you what you're looking at here because this is really neat. What you're looking at is a group of basically a 100 by 500 neuron grid representing the group of neurons that are making the jelly jar choice when the animal faces it. The height of each point on this grid tells you how active the neuron is at that location. And this particular group of neurons actually forms sort of a topographic map. You can see here what the monkey's looking at of the six choices that the monkey's going to be choosing between. Now, in this particular example, we'll turn on a blue target, a yellow target, a red target, this cyan target, magenta target, and then a mustardy target. And the order in which they're turned on, to keep it simple, is how good they are for the monkey. This one yields a lot of juice, this one a little bit less, this one a little less, this one a little less, this one a little less. You get the idea. And the activity on the map here actually faithfully maps the locations of each of those options so that the activity here is telling us something about what the monkey's thinking about this option, something here about what he's thinking about this option, and you get the idea. So now let's watch the movie as we turn on just two options. Here, a really good option and a sort of crummy option. Now let's turn on another option. That's here. You can see these two are sort of suppressed by it. And as we add more and more targets, you can't even see them, they shrink these peaks down until they're invisible. Now, what this means is that the monkeys start to screw up because they can't decide. What this is showing us is that they can't represent six jellies correctly. As we go from two jellies, which they can represent accurately, to six jellies, they screw up. Why do they screw up? Well, the neat thing is that Ryan and Kenway are I think, about 95% of the way to proving that what's constrained here is how much information the monkey can pack into that map. As we ask the monkey to keep track of more and more things in that map, he does a worse and worse job. Why? Because he only has so many neurons and he has so much information he has to carry. A 500 by 100 map can do a great job of keeping information about a couple of jellies, but not about six jellies. Now here's the hitch. So if the monkey wants to do better, he has to add more neurons, right? He has to devote more neurons to the task. But the problem is neurons are costly. Neurons, in fact, are the most costly tissue in your body. 20 to 25% of your heart's output is diverted to your brain, even though it weighs only about 2.5% of your total body mass. So neurons are the most costly tissue in the brain. What Kenway and Ryan seem to have discovered is that the amount of information you can pack into a neural network is pretty limited. This leads to errors. You can solve those errors by buying more neurons, but neurons are costly. Of course, that leads us to think about this problem in a slightly different way. In blue, I'm plotting for you how good a job you do about finding the jellies as a function of how many neurons you use. And you can see the more neurons you get, this is a theoretical curve, the more neurons you get, the better job you do keeping track of all the jellies. But in red, I'm plotting for you the metabolic cost of that. It's real cheap. This is kind of, only an economist thinks of costs this way. They're kind of inverse costs, because paying less is good if you're an economist. So this top corner says, oh, good. I didn't have to pay very much because I had very few neurons. This bottom corner is I had to pay a lot because I had to buy a lot of neurons. And so there are two things going on. I'm getting more juice as I add neurons, but I'm paying more to get more juice as I'm adding neurons. So what this really raises is the possibility that where we see human inefficiencies, it's true they're inefficient with regard to jelly, but they may not be inefficient with regard to life. The limitations that we impose, that our brains impose on us, may actually be hugely efficient, because overcoming those limitations may just be more costly than it's worth. Now, if that's true, then that implies that our behavior is efficient even when it doesn't look that way. And at least for some cases, like this one that Ryan and Kenway have studied, we can really prove that that's true, or we're beginning to be able to prove that that's true. What looks silly is silly because the cost of being not silly is too expensive. And that's exactly the kind of efficient maximization that economists predict. Now, they haven't actually been able to demonstrate that very often because they haven't known about the hidden biological costs. But once we get them, then we can see that these processes look even more and more alike. All right, let me leave you with this thought. We know for sure that natural selection pushes animals towards higher levels of fitness. We don't really know how fit animals are. But convergent evolution is kind of neat and suggests that they're more fit than they are not fit. And the kinds of efficiency measurements I've shown you suggest, again, maybe animals are more fit than we might suspect. I think this is, I've included my beloved glass half full here. You know, you can take this as a glass half full or glass half empty. You know, the curators in the audience are all thinking, well, he kind of left out game theory, and we know game theory leads to suboptimal solutions, and there are lots of circumstances in which we can prove animals don't hit the maxima, they're not perfectly fit, that's absolutely true, but it's striking how close they often get. And I think that the same is really true about human decision making. The more we learn about it, the more efficient it looks. Even the weird paradoxical errors people seem to make look like they're satisfying some evolutionary constraint. And so what this has led a group of the neuroeconomists to argue is that what natural selection is really doing is pushing animals towards utility maximization. Now, just like evolution and gene frequencies, I don't really want to argue that we hit it perfectly. Of course we don't. And of course this is an issue of seeing the glass half empty or the glass half full. But I think the evidence is that the human brain, when it makes decisions, does a lot better than we think it might at first blush. And it really seems to suggest that the human brain, the product of natural selection and evolution, The thing that maximizes our fitness behaviorally does so on the other side of the coin by maximizing utility, the welfare correlate of our fitness in human life. Thank you very much for your attention. So I sort of brought the train into the station on time, and that means that we have time for some questions if people want to ask. I know there are microphones floating around. There's someone right here down in the middle. Someone back there. Third row left.
You note properly.
Wait, that's not on. Can you turn on those mics? Try it again.
Hello?
I don't know which mic that is, but it is not working.
D3.
No? Okay, well, I'll repeat it.
Okay.
Great question. Do you want me to go from there?
Your presentation is that your presentation's
presumption is that the environment is static, and that's clearly false.
Okay, so this is such a great question. Let me flesh it out and make it much more hostile than you made it, because it's really...
Oh, wait, I have an add-on to that.
Okay, go ahead.
The add-on is your comment about multidimensionality could be reduced, for example, to distance in a multidimensional space.
I think the dimensional reduction is kind of not that hard a problem mathematically. Let's talk about that in a minute. Let's talk about your first part, which is dynamite. So let's imagine the universe was stationary, the universe that an animal lives in, the environment was fixed. Then evolution is moving, pushing an animal towards a fixed goal. Everybody get this idea? That peak is always there. But the environment really changes. That's a really important fact. One of the famous examples of this is once coal started to be burnt regularly in Britain. There was a lot of soot, and the trees started to turn black. And moths, which had evolved this really... you know what?
The discrediting was discredited. Okay. I stand corrected.
Let me pick a different story. let's take a different example. The color of some foliage changes for some reason. And a green chameleon, who was perfectly hidden, now finds himself in a yellow forest being eaten by everything in sight. Okay, so if we come upon that green chameleon at the moment that the forest changes color, he looks ill-adapted. He is ill-adapted. Okay, now of course the forests tend not to change instantaneously, they change gradually, but environments change at different speeds in different places. A great example of this is the Rift Valley. That's why I love this example. Where the environments sometimes change really, really, really fast and sometimes really, really, really slowly. So here's the critical question. We know evolution pushes animals towards fitness, and it does so at some rate. But the environment's moving under those animals, and what's interesting to ask is how well are those rates matched? If evolution's a little bit faster than the rate of environmental drift, then it can keep up. And if it's slower, it can't. Now, the evidence we have on this seems to suggest that different animals handle this in different ways. The cichlids are particularly interesting because it turns out that their jaws are made up of like 60 bones. What? You know, why is that relevant? The answer is that gives them a lot of material for rapid evolution. And the cichlids seem to be a class of a group of animals that are highly specialized for rapid evolution. That's actually what they do. And they live in environments where the environment's chasing away from them really fast, and they do better than everybody else there because they can chase after the environment really, really fast. And this suggests that evolution occurs at different timescales. And that environments that are real fast-moving environments have animals that have to adapt in not just to the momentary solution, but they have to adapt to the fact that the environment is adapting. It's a sort of second-order time problem. We don't really know how good they are at that. The cichlid data is really telling here. There's some debate about how old Lake Victoria is. 10 years ago, we thought Lake Victoria was only 14,000 years old, and so the observation that the newest group of fish had achieved about a halfway step from their single progenitor we now know that they have a single progenitor from genotyping, to sort of the what looked like the convergent endpoint in 10,000 years looked pretty good. Now, we now think that Lake Victoria is 100,000 years old, and so we have evidence that they haven't quite got there in 100,000, so the cichlids, maybe it takes them 200,000 or 300,000 or 400,000 years to fit their environment pretty well. We know in Tanganyika they've pretty much nailed it, and that's 1 million years. So that tells us what fast evolvers are limited to. We don't really know what the slow end looks like, but I mean, I'm kind of cautiously optimistic here. I think that when we look at environments that are reasonably stable, we ought to expect things to work out pretty well. When we look at environments that are really unstable, we ought to see things work out not so well. Now that's real interesting for us, because we live in a highly unstable environment. I'm real interested in consumer choice. That's another thing I study. And you know, an American supermarket, not ours here in New York, but in the rest of the country, an American supermarket has about 40,000 goods in it. When you walk into a cereal aisle with 500 goods, I mean, people just pick a choice. Now, this is an interesting question because it suggests that Homo futurius, the future humans, are going to have to commit a lot more brain architecture to the cereal aisle, right? And that they'll do so as long as the cereal aisle provides enough benefit. Okay, so that's a hard, that's not an experiment we can do, but it would be neat to come back in 500,000 years. If the cereal aisles will just stay the same for 500,000 years, we can see whether or not the adaptation occurs.